we save ourselves still. What do you say now?
What I said earlier is, let me just repeat that, which is that there really are no thresholds. You know, 1 degree of warming, which is where we are now, there are impacts associated with that. Some of them are really bad impacts. You know, we're probably going to hit 1.5 degrees in, you know, the next decade, or maybe a little bit beyond that. That's going to be worse than 1 degree. You know, hopefully we can stop the warming by 2 degrees. I'm optimistic we can do that. Every tenth of a degree of warming makes it worse. So I don't look at this as a binary situation where it's disaster or not disaster. I look at it as sort of this continuum. There are bad impacts now at 1 degree of warming, globally averaged. They'll be worse at 1.2 degrees or 1.4 degrees, 1.6 degrees, 1.8 degrees. But we just need to stop it. And when we stop it, then the impacts will stop getting worse. And that's really what we need to focus on.
From Texas A&M University, we have been speaking with atmospheric scientist Professor Andrew Dessler. Find links to the papers and videos we discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org, along with more notes on the big role of water vapor in the climate story. Andrew, it's been a treat to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In a presentation on climate reality, Andrew Dessler explained how big oil and gas downplay the horrible risks using strategies from the rearguard action by tobacco companies. Here's a short clip from Good Morning America in 1982. After the Surgeon General of the United States reported tobacco definitely causes cancer and other diseases, this is the ploy by Bill Dwyer, Vice President of the Tobacco Institute, on TV. See if you can translate it into global warming talk by fossil fuel companies and their lobbyists today.
Today, the government released a new report on smoking and health, which said that there is overwhelming evidence that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer and is a major factor in heart disease. The tobacco industry says that there is no conclusive evidence that smoking causes cancer or heart disease. Yesterday, we discussed this new report with the United States Surgeon General, Julius Richmond, and John Pinney of Health, Education, and Welfare. And this morning, Bill Dwyer, who is Vice President of the Tobacco Institute, is with us, and Steve Bell joins our conversation from Washington. Good morning, Mr. Dwyer.
Good morning, David. Thank you very much.
But if everybody made the choice to quit smoking, then, of course, there wouldn't, let's say, be any more tobacco industry. So it's in the interest of the industry to keep people smoking if they're going to continue to make a profit. Why should the public believe you as opposed to believing the Surgeon General and all the doctors and the reports from the government?
David, I don't think it's quite so much a matter of believing us versus someone else. It's believing what the facts are. And the facts shouldn't all come from a single source. It isn't really just our statement of contradiction or difference with the Surgeon General. There are many independent men and women of science who don't believe that the causal conclusion yet has been reached. David, we don't deny that there is statistical evidence. Smokers in greater number than non-smokers do fall victim to these various diseases. But we must remember that, for example, most smokers don't develop lung cancer, and certain non-smokers do as well. We think it's an open question.
Not everyone will die from climate change, and some of those folks would have died anyway. Tobacco spokesman Bill Dwyer on Good Morning America in 1982, laying out all the lines now used by the oil, gas, and coal companies. They want to pacify you as the world heats beyond recognition so they can burn their profitable products. Coming up, drying lakes around the world, and that new Dolly Parton song, an anthem for action in the heat. Experts say about one quarter of the world's population resides in a basin of a drying lake. In fact, half the world's lakes are shrinking. Why? And what does it mean? We reached Dr. Ben Livney, author of a new study just published in Science May 18th. Ben is a civil engineer and associate professor at the University of Colorado, Boulder. We tracked Ben down in Israel. From Israel, Ben Livney, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thank you so much, Alex. Great to be here.
There are some surprises and new worries in this work. What did lead author Fangfang Yao and your team set out to discover?
Yeah, so we kind of set out to discover what the largest lakes in the world have been doing over the past 30 years. We had access to some new satellite data that could tell us about changes in elevation and footprint, so we could actually calculate volume changes. And we wanted to understand what was driving changes in lake water volume across the globe.
Well, in January 2022, a team of scientists from Nanjing University of Geography published a study finding, quote, a net water mass gain in global lakes. It seems like your team found the opposite. How does that work?
So I think a lot of it comes down to the number of lakes and which lakes people are looking at. So some studies look at a large number of lakes, smaller lakes as well, and it kind of depends on how you do arithmetic, I guess. So we took the 2,000 or so largest lakes, which represent about 87% of freshwater on Earth, and we showed that about a little over half of those are declining, and of those, a little more than half of the decline is actually caused by humans, either directly or indirectly.
Are there certain parts of the world where lakes are losing water, like deserts or tropical zones?
Yeah, so we found, generally speaking, more declines in lake water levels in arid regions. Although we did also find declines in humid regions, we found more declines in arid regions and also in areas that are close to very large human populations where humans are diverting and consuming water.
But not all lakes are declining, right?
That's right. And we found an increasing lake water storage in a number of places distributed throughout the globe, but in particular in cooler places, colder climates like in northern Canada, for example, there's sort of a hot spot of increasing lake water storage.
Although you found that Arctic lakes are generally in decline, and that surprised me because I thought, well, the Arctic is supposed to get wetter as the world warms. What's going on with Arctic lakes?
So actually, in some parts of the Arctic, well, we know that temperatures are rising across the globe, and we also know that the Arctic is seeing some of the largest increases in temperature across the planet. And so what we found was that rising temperatures actually have contributed to some of the decline in these northern lakes. And we sort of looked at what was the largest contributor to lake water decline. And in a lot of those cases, it was temperature.
So I guess we need to learn this new term, potential evapotranspiration, or PET. So I'm guessing that a warmer atmosphere will hold more water and it's sucking some up out of the lakes. Is that what's going on?
Well, you can kind of think about it like a warmer atmosphere is able to hold more moisture, which means it's able to pull more water away from the land and away from the lakes. So in a way, a warmer atmosphere is a thirstier atmosphere. And so when we talk about this term PET that you just described, that's really what we're getting at. It's atmospheric demand for water that's going up, generally together with rising temperatures.
Could you describe a couple of lakes in decline, maybe where there are a lot of people living around them, and what that means for those people in the surrounding basin?
Yeah, so there's a few examples. And I think if we want to think about examples of sort of good management versus bad management. So in general, I would just say first that temperature, rising temperatures and evaporation contribute to fairly widespread declines in lake water, but those tend to not be these huge sort of disastrous landscape shifting declines. The cases where you have the biggest decline are essentially these cases where humans are diverting and consuming water in an unsustainable way. So some examples, for example, the Aral Sea, which is in the former Soviet Union, it at one time in the 1960s was one of the top five largest lakes in the world. And because of diversion of the two rivers that flow into it, it's now declined by over 90%. So it's not even in the top 10 or top 20 anymore. You know, the Dead Sea is an example of a lake where diversions have essentially caused major declines. The water level is going down by something like 1 meter per year over the past 40 years. So that's a lot. Here, you know, or when we think about Colorado and the Colorado River Basin, some of those big reservoirs, people have done a good job setting up these thresholds or points at which they declare a shortage. And really what I think that embodies is that lake water levels and really healthy lake water levels are a priority. These systems where there's certain, you know, points at which we change our management strategies.
But it seems in some places where you don't have good water management and the lakes are shrinking, people feel even more stressed for water. They want more irrigation water. And so it's almost like a positive feedback effect that drier lakes might lead to drier lakes because of the human reaction.
You're absolutely right. There tends to be this feedback loop. If you think about a drought, for example, a drought is usually a period of high temperatures and a higher demand for water. And yet, at the same time, there's a reduced supply. And so you have this pernicious loop. I think that another element of declining lakes is also just this sort of change in people's sense of place, sense of their sort of surroundings, because we know that humans love living on the waterfront. It's a very, you know, desirable real estate location. And when lakes decline and shorelines may recede far from communities. And so it can also be not just like a financial or a, you know, resource question, but it's also this more sort of human intangible experience, losing access to the waterfront.
So your study finds almost half, if I understood it right, almost half the total loss of global lake storage comes from just one place, the Caspian Sea. I had to look that up because Iran calls the Caspian a lake and Kazakhstan calls it a sea, but it is fresh water. So how does its big role in water decline, does it reduce our worries about lake loss in other countries because half of it's coming from this one place?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Caspian Sea indeed has a large impact, but even when we remove the Caspian Sea, we had essentially the same result, more than half of the lakes declining, and with still notable volume declines, even when you remove them. So I think the Caspian Sea is obviously important, and yes, it is a freshwater body, but it doesn't sort of steal the show.
Well, closer to your university, last year the Utah Department of Natural Resources announced Great Salt Lake could dry up in less than 5 years. And this year's wet winter in the West partially refilled the lake. How can you rule out long-term natural cycles or extreme events like we are seeing this year in your general study trends?
Yes, there are long-term cycles and there are extreme years. And so our study really just covers the period of 1992 to 2020. And so one of the sort of grains of salt to take study is that it is specific to those years. And in places where maybe things were wetter than average at the start of the time period, we would then see some kind of an artificial decline. Or if things, you know, if there was an anomalous change, some unusual event happened, that would be picked up. And so that's always the challenge with these types of studies, is to try to capture the, what would you say, like a representative trend, despite all the noise and all the variability.
Well, also surprising, human-controlled reservoirs added more water storage than global lakes lost. So we've overcome any loss of water storage. Problem solved?
I appreciate your optimism. Actually, one of the chief contributors to that reservoir storage gain is simply these new reservoirs that were filled for the first time. And so I'm kind of afraid that that signal might be masking what's going on a little bit, because those new reservoirs, essentially, it's a one-time thing that they're being filled, and that added water, I don't think is really representative of the global picture in general.
And the reservoirs are not as permanent as we'd like to think. Some are losing storage capacity, and it's not just climate change. Talk to us about the role of sediments. Are they a long-term problem in the future, or are they already important?
Yeah, so sediments in reservoirs is, a big problem. It's an existential problem. And just for listeners who may not be aware, the way this works is that our rivers tend to carry sediment in them from the channel, from the hill slopes. And when that river water stops moving or slows down, then those small particles settle to the bottom of the reservoir. And that may not seem like a lot in the short run, but after a few years or a few decades, that can sometimes mean a significant loss of total storage. And if we think about reservoirs as the long-term storage infrastructure, then that really starts to change their utility. And it really raises a lot of questions about water security in the long run. And so I see it as a very serious issue. I think that humans are smart and have a lot of ingenuity to get around any problem. But I think that this is one that will take a lot of careful thinking.
And we're counting on hydroelectric as part of our green energy plan to power the future. Are some hydroelectric projects threatened by loss of water in either lakes or reservoirs?
Yeah, I think anytime you have a big change in lake water storage, you are running into concerns about the viability and the sustainability of hydropower. So I think that's a very real question and concern. I think it's a case-by-case type of thing because a lot of it comes down to the elevation of the intake for your hydropower and how high or how low that is relative to the elevation of your water level. Sediment plays a role. I'm thinking more about reservoirs here than natural lakes. And so there's a lot of interesting but challenging questions related to that hydropower piece.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest from University of Colorado Boulder is Dr. Ben Livney. We're talking about new science showing half of the world lakes are losing water. When it comes to human damage to the environment, climate change certainly isn't everything, but I can't help thinking that this lake shrinking problem could get worse as the climate heats up. But what are your thoughts, Ben?
And so, well, what do we know about the way climate may change? So we're quite confident that things are going to get warmer. And actually, there's also some reason to believe that things may get a little bit wetter. So there may be more precipitation as we go forward. And it'll really come down to the balance between those two things. I think in many places, we will see more drying because of the warming. But because reservoirs and lakes tend to be these sort of collection basins, I also think we're going to get an upshot in some places. So I'm still sort of optimistic about things that, you know, on balance, we should be okay. But I think each reservoir is going to be a unique case. And just raising awareness, taking more observations so we have a better sense of what's going on, that's going to be kind of the path forward.
Yeah, we don't have official bodies who measure the size and depth of every lake around the world. So how did your team manage to put all this together?
Right. Well, that was exactly the problem that we were thinking about, is that most existing observations of reservoirs are taken with local observations, and sometimes that information is not really available, either due to a lack of sharing or a lack of availability. So we used a global satellite, actually, to estimate the lake water storage. The first thing that we did was we took a new suite of satellites that can tell you the elevation of the water across these reservoirs. The second satellite tells you something about the footprint of the reservoir and how that's changing. And so if you know about changes in the height of the reservoir and you know changes about the footprint, you can actually calculate changes in volume. And the nice thing about that, because it uses satellites, is it's sort of available, you could say, roughly everywhere, because these are space-borne instruments. And so that's how we were able to observe such a large part of it.
And the amount of data behind this study is just unimaginable. Your group credits better algorithms and computer cloud processing. Ben, how long do you think it'll be before artificial intelligence makes the next breakthrough in your field?
It really depends on how you define artificial intelligence, because you could argue that in some ways, artificial intelligence is already a part of this study in the way that we attributed the different causes for the lake water change using these different algorithms. And so in many ways, I think that artificial intelligence is here and is already contributing. But when it comes to sort of coming up with these new ideas and innovative methods, I think we're pretty far still from artificial intelligence being sort of the creator of some of those methods. But instead, it's more of a collaborator with the human scientist at this point.
I could see a situation, though, where you have artificial intelligence combing through masses and masses of satellite data, and it comes up with a pattern that humans just haven't noticed. Oh, by the way, look, lakes are shrinking. You know, I think that could happen.
Oh, for sure. And I think that you do already see some of that happening now. I think we just have to come up with the interesting questions and then unleash the power of these computers and these algorithms to help us do the rest.
So getting back to the climate front, how would less water on world lakes change the impact of the greenhouse gas emissions that we put up into the atmosphere?
Well, less water, you know, in the extreme case, could lead to shortages of water, shortages of food. And you mentioned hydropower. There's also recreation and navigation. All of these things are affected by water levels. So that's kind of a direct impact. But, you know, when you think about how interconnected things are, and the global supply chain of food and goods and services, I think one of the probably most tangible impacts of any kind of sustained loss of global lake water would be just kind of affecting the cost of goods, the availability of goods, that kind of thing. That isn't to say that humans and our supply chain can't get better and be more adaptive, but I think that there's certainly stressors that we would feel if lakes were declining more significantly.
We've had protest movements gathering to save the whales and the trees. Is it time to save the lakes, and what could be done for them?
You know, that's a great, great sentiment, actually. I think our lakes are super important, and we're just very lucky to have them because they're just this excellent resource that's very accessible. I think the biggest thing, and really any solution, will involve a combination of awareness. So making it a priority to measure and report what's happening. So, you know, the current study that we did is like an example of this. We made a step towards improving our knowledge of what's actually happened so far. And then, of course, the second part would have to be something more actionable. So making it a priority to have healthy lake levels. This would come from sort of the policy or governance, kind of like what we see on the Colorado River Basin reservoirs.
And some lakes are connected directly to glaciers, and I guess changes in that ice world could add freshwater storage for a short period of time while the glaciers melt and then subtract when they're gone.
That's absolutely right, and there's a lot of concerns over that happening, in particular in some of the larger glacier systems like in the Himalayas in Asia, where you have significant amounts of almost prehistoric water that has the potential to be released at an unsustainable rate, like you say, a short-term boom, but then a long-term decline.
From the University of Colorado Boulder, our guest is hydrology expert Dr. Ben Livnay. With lead author Fang-Fang Yao, Ben co-wrote the paper titled Satellites Reveal Widespread Decline in Global Lake Water Storage. You can find links to more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ben, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We just have time for a bit of Dolly Parton's new song, World on Fire, released in May 2023. You can find it on YouTube or dollyparton.com. Thanks, Dolly. I'm Alex Smith, over and out for this week's Radio EcoShock.
Still got time to turn it all around. much. Everybody's tripping over this or that. What we're gonna do when we all fall flat?
Coming up next week, why are we heading hell-bent into a world that nobody wants? Social philosopher Daniel Spattenberger has the best explanation. He warns artificial intelligence to this unsustainable system will speed the decline towards disaster for humanity. Daniel talks with UK science communicator, television presenter, and former professional poker player Olivia Livbury. Then we talk wildfires and climate change with Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan. This is a new interview. Mike Flanagan explains why burning the Great North boreal forests could change world climate for everyone. Tune in to Radio EcoShock next week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Nobody is trying to desertify the planet. Nobody wants climate change or the venusification of the planet. Why can't we change them?